Busy city life makes it hard to think about and work at integrating our faith with our lives. Welcome to the Cathedral Podcast, produced and hosted by Jenny Ho Huan. Each episode, we want to help you relate core Christian truths to your daily life. Whether it's science, philosophy, cultural trends, or life stories, we bring you authentic and unrehearsed conversations to spark insight and strengthen your faith and your life.
Hi, everyone. Very glad to have Dr. Raja Velu with me in this conversation about mental health. Dr. Velu is consultant psychiatrist with a special interest in community psychiatric and neurodevelopmental disorders. Hi, Raja. Glad to have you with us.
Hi, Jenny. Thanks for inviting me into this podcast. It's really an honor.
Oh, not at all. It's wonderful to be able to draw from the wisdom in the body of Christ here in Singapore. There's plenty. And yeah, this podcast is really just our way of putting up the voices and the heartbeat of many Christians in Singapore out there so that we can be more connected and we can serve each other better and grow stronger together. Well, you worship at Yio Chu Kang Chapel, and I believe it's one of the first church to hold a mental health conference. Was that last year or year before?
It was September 2019.
Just last year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we want to have this conversation because, you know, the state of mental health is reaching quite crisis proportions with more awareness, but also because with the fact that society is becoming more fraught, more stress and all that. And of course, right now with the pandemic, we are seeing a spike, an increase in people feeling mental anguish. So just to get us started, maybe we start with the definition of what is a healthy mental state?
Okay. That is a tricky question, actually. So because it really depends on who you ask that question to. So if you ask a doctor, a psychiatrist, we'll probably say that it's not just absence of mental illness, but it's also really how positively we feel, think, and act in a stressful situation, or how we cope with stressful situation. Now some might also say that it's really how well you are psychologically, emotionally, or socially when facing stress. But if you ask this question to maybe a fitness instructor, you know, he'll say that actually, you know, your mind can never be healthy if you are not physically healthy. So he will say that yes, you know, you need physical health, and then you'll have mental health. But if you ask, you know, maybe a pastor, and then a pastor might say, you know, spirituality is actually a very important health aspect of mental health as well. So without that, you know, how are we going to be mentally healthy? So I personally, with my experience, I realized that, you know, there are three components. It's actually a bit of everything. Yep. So in order to have a healthy mental state, you need to have healthy mind, healthy thinking, and then you need to have healthy body, and also spiritually, you have to be healthy. So when all these three aspects come together, that's when we are truly healthy in terms of our mental state.
Okay, thanks for that. Yeah, so because we are complex creatures, and in one Greek schema, we are body, soul, and spirit. So that kind of aligns with what you're saying, that mental health or mental wholeness or mental wellness even has got to do with the way we think, which of course, because we are housed in physical bodies, is then probably related to how we feel about ourselves physically. And because we are souls, then it's related to how we understand our relationship with God, and also being social beings, how our relationship with others. So it's not like you have eaten this amount of this and then you have attained mental health. It's a very dynamic thing. So you could be sort of basically mentally healthy, but you have moments of maybe mental weakness in that sense. Maybe one of these components is not doing so well, so you are affected. You are somewhat compromised, as it were. So at what point would a person be said to have moved towards mental ill health and would therefore need professional psychiatric care or psychological care?
Oftentimes emotions are normal. You know, depression, feeling depressed, feeling anxious. So those are actually normal emotions. So, you know, we have ups and downs in our life. You know, a day we might feel a bit down, and then after that we are up and running, like back to normal. So when a mental illness sets in, it's when these symptoms are actually progressively worsening.
Mm.
And it starts affecting our day-to-day activities. For example, you know, a student who's studying is unable to study, or someone who's working is unable to focus at work, or it's really affecting our day-to-day functioning, our ability to socialize. And usually it's a progressive sort of thing. So it gets worse over time. So that's when mental illness really sets in. So I hope, you know, it's sort of a test of function. So the more your function deteriorates, the more likely that you're facing a mental illness rather than just ups and down of mood.
Okay, so to take an analogy, let's say if every day you were able to basically carry your laptop in your backpack, you know, and then one day you just feel, well, that suddenly feels really heavy. You should probably be alert to what's going on, right? Because your functioning has somewhat been affected or compromised. And then you observe it for a couple of weeks and see if it's getting worse. And if you feel like it's getting worse, it's not recovering, you might have tried a few things, it's not improving, then that's a clear signal that you need medical attention, professional help, maybe seeing a psychologist or psychiatrist. Okay, so I also want to ask you to help us here. What's the difference between seeing a psychologist and seeing a psychiatrist?
Okay. So, you know, even my patients, you know, they get confused. So they ask me these questions, like, you know. So sometimes they come and I think they're seeing a psychologist, and I realize it's a psychiatrist. So the difference is, psychiatrists, we are medical doctors.
Mm.
So we are medical doctors who specialize in the assessment and treatment of mental illness. So just like a doctor who specializes in heart condition, liver, lung condition. So we are doctors, so we have to go through medical school training. Psychologists, on the other hand, they are actually specialized in psychotherapy, so talking therapy. It's a bit more than counseling, but counseling is part of therapy as well. So they're not medical doctors, but they specialize in giving talking therapy.
Okay, so I would say if I feel unwell, out of sorts, and I think it's because I can't think straight, maybe I should see a psychologist. But if after talking to psychologists, I feel like there's something more going on, and it might be biological in origin, right? It might be chemical in origin.
Yeah.
Then I should see a psychiatrist. I mean, I'm just sharing my personal take. I feel like seeing a psychiatrist is a step up from seeing a psychologist. I feel like we should try and talk it through first. Let's talk it out and see.
Yeah.
If I can't talk or some there's further impediments, then I might need some kind of medical intervention. Is that a fair enough thing to say?
Yeah, I think fair enough, because a lot of my referrals, it really comes in from other, you know, counselors, psychologists, GPs. So it's seldom that the patient will just come straight to me. So usually I get a referral from somewhere else. So
right.
I think what's important is really to seek help first. So if you see a psychologist first, usually a psychologist will be able to tell whether there's a need to see a psychiatrist. Whether you need a proper diagnosis. Is it more than just a psychological, problem that you also need maybe medication or proper diagnosis?
Right.
So yes, then they will actually refer the patient to a psychiatrist. So I think what's important is to seek help. So, you know, if you feel that you're not well, you know, just go out, see someone, because we know that, a lot of people, they wait for many years before they seek treatment.
Mm.
So research done in 2010, quite a few years ago, you know, it showed that even for depression, people wait, you know, for 4 years or so before they actually seek help. So the, you know, the earlier it gets treated, the better the outcome. So if you ask me, I think it's better to go and seek help and see someone early rather than later. So be a psychologist, counselor, GP. You know, it's fine. Like, so sometimes some people, they are a bit more, anxious to see a psychiatrist, like you said, you know, to step up, right? Yeah. So it's okay to see a psychologist, a counselor first.
Yeah. Good point. Start with your family doctor and slowly, you know. I mean, sometimes it may not be that serious. Sometimes it might be you just need some vitamins or some sunshine. Yeah. Okay. So from your training and your clinical experience, what would you say are the major causes that introduces mental instability and ill health?
Okay. I would say there are three big umbrellas. And then there are a few different causes under this umbrella. So one of the common one is, you know, we call it the biological umbrella. So everything in psychiatry is biopsychosocial. So under the biological umbrella, first is genetic. You know, there's some illness that does run in the family. For example, bipolar disorder or schizophrenia is a highly genetic condition. Sometimes it does happen, you know, without not being anyone in the family members having a mental illness, but it tends to run more in the family. And sometimes it skips generations. You know, it skips like 3-4 generations ago. Mm. So we don't really track till our great-grandparents, you know, about their time, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why sometimes it may appear as if it's not genetic, but it really is genetic to a certain extent. So that's one aspect. Under the biological umbrella as well, another reason for mental illness would be substance. For example, illicit drugs, alcohol, you know, sometimes certain habit that becomes an addiction. So when it comes to substance, right, for example, marijuana, ganja, you know, so a patient can either become addicted to the substance itself and it become an illness by itself, or the substance may cause depression, or it may cause other forms of mental illness. And of course, you know, with addiction, it also have social problems and various issues that they might be facing. So another third thing under the umbrella of biological is actually other medical illnesses. For example, someone who has multiple medical problems, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, they're also at higher risk of developing a mental illness like depression or anxiety. And certain illness by itself can also cause mental illness. For example, thyroid problem. It's often associated with depression or, you know, anxiety problem. So there are various such medical illnesses that cause psychiatric symptoms or basically present your psychiatric symptoms.
Right.
So the second umbrella, you know, we're moving on from the biological umbrella. Second umbrella is psychological. So certain people, you know, we have certain personality. Some are whether warriors, some are, you know, more pessimistic, some are perfectionistic. So these personality traits can also give rise to, you know, depression or anxiety if it's a bit too overwhelming for the individual.
Right.
And then we have childhood trauma. So as a child, you know, we're supposed to be, you know, protected by our parents, being loved. But if let's say our childhood is somehow traumatized, you know, because of abuse or maybe other things that which is out of our control. So then our psychological development doesn't go through the normal process that child goes through. So that sort of, you know, we may develop some sort of psychological insecurity as we become older. And that can predispose to mental illness.
Wow.
The last umbrella is actually social. Mm. So I think this is where most people are more comfortable with. I know, for example, dealing with problems in relationships, interpersonal relationships, or, you know, stress with our work, financial problems. So these are actual stressors that actually sort of interfere with our day-to-day life and affect us, you know, badly until it triggers a mental illness. So that's roughly some of the main causes for various different mental illness.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. The three large groups where mental instability and ill health can occur, the biological, the psychological, and the social. And actually, it also feels to me that they vary in severity. I think with the social, it might be your girlfriend dumped you and then you're really upset, right? And you're predisposed to certain actions and whatever. But maybe with enough support, with enough proper processing, prayer and help, you could climb out of it. But trauma is a completely different class of thing. I mean, a lot of people are not even aware they've had childhood trauma because of suppression and stuff like that. And then, of course, when it's biological with genetics, that's something you can't physically touch. You know, you can't, it's not easy to address. So, so we are very, really, very intricate and complex beings, aren't we? And I mean, from what you share, it sounds to me like a major key to mental wholeness is actually self-awareness. And being aware of your own emotional state, being aware of your needs, cueing into times when the stress level is too much and being willing to say, this is too much. I might need some help, you know, or something is just bothering me. It just doesn't go away. Maybe signs of a trauma and so on and so forth. Great. So the flip side of it then, what would be the major factors that help with the restoration? Is it also three big groups?
I suppose we can look at each group as well and see how we can alleviate things. But I think one of the major factors, right, is really how we cope with stress. So because I realized that in all of us, we have a way of coping, right? Whenever we are stressed, some of or worse, we, you know, go and makan, you know, we eat, or some go exercise, some go for, you know, watch movie or play games. So we all have our way of coping. So if we cope positively when we're under stress and we're able to contain that stress, and it's unlikely we're going to decompensate. So it's only when you decompensate, when the stress is overwhelming, then, you know, then mental illness starts, like, you know, for example, anxiety comes or depression comes. So we really have to look into how we cope with stress. So if we really address this part, and if we, you know, if we tend to cope maladaptively, for example, some people, they drink alcohol or smoke excessively. So we really need to look into more positive way of coping.
Why don't you tell us, so I'm just going to jump in and ask you to share with us, what are some positive and good ways to cope with stress?
When we are facing stress, we really need to see, what is that stress? Is it work? You know, for example, one of the most common thing is really work. Just overwhelming. And now with, you know, work from home, people, you know, they tend to lose track of when they start, when they end work. You know, at home, you know, you're there, your computer is in front of you. Some people just basically work from morning till, you know, till very late at night. So this doesn't happen when you're actually working at the workplace, right? So it's really to see what's really happening and what's, how can it be done better. And if you find that how you're coping is really maladaptive, you know, it's the wrong way of coping, you really need to think of a different way of coping. So I always tell my patient, you know, end on time, you know, don't go beyond your working time, because work-life balance is very important. So it's, I can't give a particular example for that, because each person copes differently, and the stress they face is different, and the way they handle the stress is also is different. So we need to individualize stress management. So it's a bit difficult to answer that question. But another thing is really seeking help. So some people, they tend to bottle up everything inside. So it's actually good to you know, voice it out, share it with your friend or partner, family members, you know, about the difficulties or the problem you're facing. Sometimes just talking about it, you actually feel better.
Yeah, that's why there's a joke that it's quite useful to have a dartboard in the office with the face of your boss on it or something like that. And of course, we now with work from home, we miss all the water cooler moments when you are talking and going out for lunch with your colleagues and you're renting. I don't know whether those are maladaptive, but I know that those are very common coping mechanisms for people with stress at work. Just, you know, letting it out of the system in some ways. But two good points.
That's positive.
That's considered positive, yeah. I guess if there's no malice intended, I guess, you know, there's no malice intended. Within limits, you know. It doesn't go into burning people and very malicious kind of gossip. I think just sharing how stressed you are.
I agree.
About expectations.
Yeah, just sharing it. That's not important.
Okay, so sharing and seeking help probably largely will help are good ways to positively manage stress. That's interesting. Now, how about the fact that you are a Christian psychiatrist? Does that change any way, you know, how you approach your work?
Wow, that's a huge, because I was reflecting on that question, actually. And I've been a believer for about 8 years. So I was a junior psychiatrist before I came to know Christ. So when I was a junior psychiatrist, you know, when I personally, I would like to share a bit of my, you know, what I went through as well. So when I was a junior psychiatrist, before I came to know Christ, you know, when a patient gets better, the satisfaction is very personal. So I'll be like, okay, I've done a good job, you know, I'm happy, you know, it's because of me, you know, this patient's better. So it's very personal gratification. But now I realize, you know, when a patient gets better, it's thank God. No, it's because of God's intervention. And I look at doctors as instruments and tools that God used. So you know, the patient is not getting better because of us. It's because God has given us that power, that, you know, that wisdom to make the right decision and help this individual go through what he or she is facing. So personally, I also am seeing more and more Christian patients. I'm not sure that it's because you know, the Lord is just giving me more work, you know, sending them to me. But I do grow as a doctor. I realize I've been growing as well as I see them, I learn things. It's not that it's always me, you know, telling them what to do.
Mm.
So I also learn from my patients, actually. And that actually helps when I see other patients with similar kind of problems.
Right.
And I also get to see how, you know, I get to hear their stories, you know, what they went through, especially our Christian patients. What are the things that really worked? What helped them? And what are the things that sort of didn't help them? You know, I'm talking about in terms of church as a whole as well, and how in some cases, you know, really church have done an awesome job, you know. So I've had patients where pastors had brought the patient to me, or small group leaders, you know, they accompanied the individual to show support. At the same time, there are some you know, some areas that we could do better as well. So as I learn their stories, so I actually can appreciate, you know, how we as God's people, you know, can make a difference to in each other's life.
Yeah. Do you also feel like in your experience after coming to Christ, you maybe have a fresh appreciation for the fact that the healing of one of your patients actually requires more than you? It requires a community. Yes. Would you like to share a bit more about that?
Yes. So this is a part where I've so I realized sometimes, you know, when patients get better, you know, sometimes it didn't carry on. Like it there's this it doesn't sustain sometimes. You know, after a few months, you know, they find that their mood is sort of going down. So this is where the community, the support is really important.
Mm.
So the people around you make a huge difference. So the more positive they are, the more important it is. So I'll give you an example. You know, I've heard this story many times from my patients, you know, Christian patients. You know, when they go through a difficult time, you know, mental illness, for example, sometimes they do share with one or two person in church. And sometimes it's a positive thing because, for example, the small group will come together to, you know, support them, to encourage them, to pray for them. But sometimes it becomes like a rumor, you know, like the whole church will come to know about it. And when this individual steps into the church, someone will come and say, you know, I've heard what happened. And then they walk a little bit further and then someone else will come and say that. So the confidentiality is actually very important as well. So I think a smaller group, right, looking into someone, an individual with mental illness is better than, you know, the whole church coming to know about it. So we have to be a bit more mindful, you know, when someone share, you know, their difficulties to us, we still need to really do our best to make sure that the confidentiality is preserved. So it's not to tell a large group of people, but to try to come together and support the individual. So this is the part where the community plays a huge role. I think we as God's people, you know, should be, and because our congregation, we meet like weekly basis, right? And now we're meeting over the Zoom and all that. So it's important that to a certain extent, we should keep the community that's involved in helping the individual smaller, so that we don't sort of spread news, so that makes the things difficult for whoever it is, you know, going through a difficult time.
Yeah. I think there's definitely place for the church to have groups of people being trained to know how to do this properly. Not just the confidentiality, but how to offer that sense of presence without judgment, but also how to look out for warning signs, like when we should remind the person. Actually, one of the things I've realized is I've journeyed with people who are recovering from mental illness is a lot of times they struggle with keeping up with their medication. And I think this is also where a community is really useful. Because sometimes they just get so down about having to take medication. It makes them feel sick. So a community that gets around and just reminds them, it's okay, you know, take your medication. Maybe I'll take with you this morning. I'll take my vitamins and you take your medication. Well, I don't know how to do it, but I just think I think from a medical point of view, that consistency in adhering to the prescription is very critical, right? What has your experience been about this?
Yeah, see, when it comes to taking medications for, say, diabetes or high blood pressure, you know, usually there's no problem. Patients usually will take it regularly. But I think when it comes to you know, psychiatric medication, that's there's a lot of reluctant to a certain extent. So the compliance rate, right, is actually much lower compared to, you know, those for medical illnesses like diabetes. So I always tell my patient, it's just like, you know, a mental illness is just like diabetes, you know. You know, in diabetes, the problem is in the blood, you know, you need to take your medication to keep your blood levels stable so they remain well. If you don't take, then your diabetes will flare up. So similarly with mental illness, right, so if you don't take your medications, it's going to get worse, lah. So as long as you take medication, you know, things will be stable. So this is this misconception that medication controls the way you think needs to be addressed. Yeah, so that's one common conception, actually.
Yeah, I think there's also the worry about the side effects of psychiatric drugs. Would you like to speak into that?
Actually, there's some truth to it, because psychiatric medication, especially when given at higher dose, you know, it can cause significant side effects. So this is a part where usually when we start medications, we start very low dose and then we monitor very carefully. So we really rely on the patient's feedback and family members' feedback as well. And of course, you know, there has been cases where, you know, church friends that accompany the patient inform me about the side effects that you were just going through. So usually when they're depressed, they really can't speak much, like, you know, especially about their side effects and all that. So usually this is where the family members, friends, we sort of rely on information from them. I take it very seriously. You know, when they have side effects, we really need to do something about it. There are alternative medications or different dose or alternative to medications. For example, for depression, the milder, moderate form of depression, they may not need medication. Therapy alone may be enough, you know. So that's talking therapy, doesn't involve medication. So as a doctor, we have to be careful as well. So that we don't over-medicate the patient and we are more receptive to what the patients say about the side effects. At the same time, I think it's also important for the patients also to work together with us so that we can. So the aim that we're moving towards is actually, you know, together, like concurrently, you know, rather than just doctor telling the patient what to do and then the patient just following. So that there will be communication breakdown that sense.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point that you raise about the whole ownership process, that both the patient and the community around him needs to own this healing recovery process. And then it's dynamic as they give you feedback, right?
Yeah.
So again, that reinforces the need that there needs to be other people involved in the person's life who can observe things, because they are probably not in the best place to make some self-observations. Yeah. But, you know, I have this worry that with the rising incidence of mental health issues, we may run out of professionals to look after, to be able to look after, catch up, you know. So I'm just wondering, do you think more needs to be done a bit upstream? Maybe in terms of preventative care or education? Do you think there's an urgent need for that?
I think currently, in terms of manpower, based on my experience, I would say at least for doctors, it's sufficient. Because, you know, based on, you know, when I talk to my colleagues and all that, it's not that we are very overwhelmed in number of patients, because we actually also rely on our partners in the community a lot. We have family service center where there are a lot of counselors in the family service center. In fact, there are many such centers in the community that actually give counseling services. Psychotherapy, where that's where the bulk of the patients are. So I do think that at the moment, I do personally think that the numbers are sufficient. Yes, of course, you know, we can always do with more psychologists, doctors. But at the moment, I think personally, I think it's sufficient as the numbers. Yeah.
Okay, but I'm just thinking, you know, with the amount of stress that is going up. And actually, the other concern is also the median age of patients is getting younger. Like we have, I mean, when I was growing up, there was no psychiatric ward, but there's one, there's a child ward in KKH for children undergoing emotional distress. And I think in the Institute of Mental Health as well, you have younger patients now. So, you know, so there is that concern. And actually, it really puzzles me when you talk about the three large groups, the biological, the psychological, and the social. when it's coming from a younger and younger age, which of these large groups is it coming from? It's quite unlikely to be social because they're still so young, especially with children. So then we might be talking more about psychological causes or biological causes. And if that is the case, then we are seeing a strange rising incidence in that, though. Yeah.
So you're asking which age group most of these patients come from, is it?
No, I'm just saying that the average age of patients is younger. We have more younger people seeking psychological and psychiatric help. I'm wondering why that is so. Yeah. And what may be the causes?
Yeah. I think one thing I can think of is really the awareness. So compared to back then, you know, years ago, the awareness of mental illness and the import and just generally the public conception about the importance of seeking help, it's a lot more. So I realize I agree with you. I see more young people nowadays coming forward with, you know, more open about sharing their psychiatric conditions or the difficulties they're facing. And I suppose the older generations, you know, they came from back then, the more resilient population. So because of that, you know, they may not be so worried about their mental health or, you know, more resilient. Maybe they don't see it as an issue. So I do agree with you. I do see more younger people coming forward. And I think probably it has got to do with the generation gap and the awareness itself.
I'm sure there are multiple factors. I mean, the world is just getting more complex, you know. I mean, you know, we all talk about how volatile it is, uncertain and all that. And family units individually are more stressed than before, with both parents working in challenging jobs where they are themselves stressed and needing to throw darts at the dartboard and all that. So we're just seeing on the whole, just society as a whole becoming maybe a more difficult place to navigate. And you mentioned the word resilience, which is a very important word. Why is it that the older generation seem to have been more resilient? Again, multiple factors, including how with affluence, we also live with certain expectations of life and all that. So all of that, it's in the mix, you know. And therefore, what I'm saying is if society has shifted, this mix is happening, there's this cauldron, you know, boiling on the fire, anytime it might boil over. So the old way of us doing things, which is just like wait till people get in trouble and then see a doctor, I'm thinking that will probably not be the best way to continue. Maybe it's important for us to think of let's reckon with how difficult it is now to just be a human person, you know, with social media and everything. And can we then say, in order to be a sound human being, there are these other things that we have not talked about in the past because it was not necessary, like resilience, like empathy and stuff like that.
Mm.
Can we move some of these things center stage and say, these are things we need to teach in school. These are things that parents need to be equipped to do. You know, these are things that general practitioners and family doctors need to watch out for. So that's, you know, so that we are talking about having a large safety net. We're talking about moving together as a team, as humanity is going to harder places, that we are all better equipped to do life.
I agree. So we need to look at the bigger picture and to see what are the preventive measures that we can put into place. But this really involves, you know, the whole society coming together. And implementing it. At the moment, we do have a certain extent. So we have a team which we call REACH that works with the children, teachers, you know, train them and train the, you know, they also give like training for school counselors. We do some of this, especially, you know, Health Promotion Board is very much involved in this as well. But I suppose building a society around this is very important. But this is a progressive thing.
Yes.
So this mindset, you know, it can only happen if everyone is on board together. But we can take baby steps, you know,
absolutely.
Slowly, you know, as we really aim for that. Because if we look at the number of people with mental illness, right, it's a lot, you know. It's probably, I give you an example, in Singapore, for depression, the prevalence rate, right, is about 6.3%. For schizophrenia, it's about 1%. For OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, is about 3%. So when you put all the minor psychiatric illness, it's about 18%.
Mm.
For dementia, after the age of 60, it's about 10%. So I'm just, wow. I wouldn't even say all the different diagnoses. So, we, you know, as you can see, it's a huge thing. Like, you know, when we put all of this together, you can see that the prevalence rate for mental illness is actually high. You know, it's a lot of people are suffering from mental illness, or you know, they may suffer in the future, and the number is actually large. But at the same time, it's highly stigmatized. You know, people don't talk about it. You know, it's like a taboo topic, right? So
yes, it still is. Yes, yes.
And that's why there's this huge gap, you know, from, you know, even when the individual knows he or she is suffering from mental illness, it takes them years before they actually seek help. And sometimes it's really family members who will figure out this, you know, there's something happening, and then they will really encourage the person to seek help. Even then, there's a lot of reluctance, you know, to go and see someone for help, a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So in order to overcome this, I think we all need to be on board together.
Yeah.
Over the years, I see things have been changing. I see that there are more and more work being done on prevention, promoting, you know, healthy mind, healthy body. But it needs to be a culture. We need to do it together, and everyone, we cannot wait for someone else to start doing it. So we need to really step up and really just go on and carry on, you know, with this, rather than waiting for later.
Yeah, and actually your earlier analogy about how looking at mental ill health, the same way we look at other other illnesses, you know, like high blood pressure and all that, it's just that that part, that may be another organ that's unwell, and maybe for a season or whatever. And you know, our of all the organs in our body, our brain, as well as our mind, the mystery of our mind, the brain and the mind, are actually really amazing in renewal, right? It's an organ that renews itself till the day we die. So there's actually a lot of hope in terms of restoration. But if we can frame it that way, and remove the stigma more, and realize that as a society, in the past, people may be dying due to high mortality rates due to other things. And then when we got more affluent, it's more heart disease. And now with more stress, clearly more mental illness. Yeah. So as a society, if we can see that this is sort of the trend, and then this is something that, you know, we need to really work at, we need to deal with, we can help remove the stigma, we can see that, hey, we want to be healthy together, body, soul, and spirit, and we want to have great mental health. And on that note, I was wondering whether we can talk in the last few moments about some ideas I've been hearing that have been pursued overseas in some countries, like a friendship chair in the school for the kid to sit on when she or she feels that there's nobody to talk to, or a listening chair, a listening person, and all that. Of course, in our society, we have the hotline for many years now. Samaritans of Singapore have done a great job with their hotline. But also, we need that physicality sometimes. So I'm just wondering whether, as a part of this whole larger movement in society, are these some of these ideas workable right here in a busy city like Singapore? And is it something that maybe churches should be at the forefront pioneering, like, you know, using church space in future to say, there are safe spaces here, you can come and sit, and somebody will come and just sit with you or listen to you and offer you a drink, you know. Start at the most, start it early, as it were. Start from the angle of, we're trying to encourage everybody to be mentally healthy and robust, rather than we're trying to fix you if you are unwell. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely agree with you, especially friendship chair, you know. So, because it's not a very local concept, so I got to admit, like, I actually had to Google and find out what it is. So but when I read about it, it was so beautiful, you know. It sort of gets over that stigma that is attached to mental illness, and it actually makes it easier for the individual with some sort of stress to actually seek help. So it sort of tests down that barrier that they face, lah. So I think it's a good idea, especially we as God's people, I think we should really step up, lah. You know, I think we can do more. Although in the recent 1 or 2 years, you know, we are doing a lot more, lah. So the things are changing. So I agree with you absolutely. So we should sort of lower the burden of the barrier of to seek help. So why not? You know, if you're going to move forward, it's why not we try something like that, or you know, train an individual who can be a listening person or someone who's affected with mental illness. But again, this kind of concept, we should really go ahead and implement it and just give it a go, you know. And
yeah,
then
rather than not sit around and talk about it endlessly.
Yeah, as we move forward, we can sort of change it accordingly to sort of fit our local culture more. So I think it's absolutely awesome idea.
Thank you. Let's hope all the church leaders listening to this and all of you listening to this will go and agitate for this. And of course, volunteer to be that listening person and volunteer to sit in that chair if somebody should come by. And it's true. I mean, the Bible tells us to be slow to speak, slow to anger, and quick to listen. And, you know, sometimes when I read scripture, I realize that there's so much power in the Word of God to really tell us how the human being is designed to operate. If we really obey scripture, we can help each other to flourish. We can help each other get out of ditches that we accidentally, unintentionally fall into. I mean, that's just life. But it's so important that we are there for one another because God showed us that He is there for us because He came for us, didn't He? Yeah. Any just closing comments for anyone, especially those listening who may right now wonder, I don't feel quite myself. What would you say to that person?
So my advice would be, right, you know, don't wait till it's too long, because we know mental illness is very, very common. So the longer we wait before we seek help, the worse the prognosis, or the more difficult it is to treat. For example, you know, if it's mild, they may not need medication. They can just be a psychologist. But if they leave it long, then they may need medication. So, or a lot longer period to recover. So the earlier they seek treatment, the better it is. So yes, for individuals who are suffering from mental illness, please come forward, and there's a lot of help available. If you're not comfortable to see a psychiatrist, you can see a GP or a counselor or a psychologist. And for those loved ones who see, their family members suffering from mental illness, you know, this is a time to really encourage them to seek help as well. Because I know, looking at the stats that we have, probably, 70% plus people out there with mental illness not seeking any treatment. So I know they're out there. It's time to seek help. And if you know someone with mental illness, please encourage them to seek help.
Yeah, thank you so much. On that note, everyone, remember, seeking help is not a sign necessarily of weakness. It doesn't have to be something you need to despair about. In fact, seeking help is a sign of ownership. It's a sign that you're taking your life seriously. And, you know, God designed our lives to flourish, to thrive. And maybe a better vision for our own life and the life of our communities, our family, and our churches is that we want to help each other to thrive. We don't want to just get by, cope, and come under the stress and break under that stress. So, you know, with God on our side, let's encourage one another to do that. And before I go to, I want to recommend a book that has come right out of the community that's been journeying with stories from people who have recovered from mental health. Good News for Bruised Reeds, which is put out by Grace Works. It's Good News for Bruised Reeds, Mental Health and the Gospel Community. So you may want to get hold of that book from Grace Works. And again, remember, our mind, our brain is a part of our entire complex human being. And God has called us to take care of it because He loves us and He has saved us, body, soul, and spirit. Thank you again, Dr. Velu, so much for your conversation
Thank
with
you.
Us today. God bless you in your work and in you, body, soul, and spirit. We bless you too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening in. We hope you've been encouraged with some new thoughts on faith and life integration. You can find us on the Cathedral app, iTunes, Spotify, or at cathedral.org.sg/podcast. Be sure to join us again.